Hi there, esteemed audience, and welcome to another episode of Middle Grade Ninja. I'm your host, Rob Kent, and as you know, I'm the author of Banneker Bones and the Giant Robot Bees, which is available as an audiobook, a paperback, but the ebook, esteemed audience, the ebook is free to download whenever you're watching or listening to us, wherever fine ebooks are sold. Don't worry about me. I'm going to get your money when you come back for Banneker Bones and the Alligator People and Banneker Bones and the Cyborg Conspiracy. Under the super secret pen name Robert Kent, I've written some novels for older readers, such as my young adult novel, All Together Now, A Zombie Story, and many other fine selections. You can find out more information about my books, more information about me, and more importantly, interviews with thousands of authors, editors, literary agents, publicists, all the best people. All of those interviews, as well as guest posts written by industry professionals, are available at middlegradeninja.com. I couldn't be more thrilled. Today we are joined by none other than Lakita Wilson. Lakita, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Glad to be through that ridiculously long intro. It's done. So, and I'm thrilled to talk with you. I very much enjoyed Be Real, Macy Weaver, and I've got all kinds of questions for you about it. Esteemed audience knows that I never make you sit through me summarizing either your book or your background, because I'll get it wrong and you'll be right here and you could have done it right. And what a waste of everybody's time for me to do it. So if you would give esteemed audience kind of an overview of your background and we'll go from there.
Sure. I'm Lakita Wilson and I'm from Maryland, a little city outside of Washington, D.C. And by day, I'm a college professor and I teach early childhood education. So I teach all of the teachers how to work with young children. And by early morning and night, I write middle grade. And I write middle grade, a little YA. I sprinkle in a little nonfiction. And I just try to write as much for young children up to young adults as I can.
Sure. And so Steve obviously loves a good origin story. What's the first time you can remember thinking, I want to be an author someday?
Okay, well, that's an interesting story, actually. Apparently, I was a very dramatic child who wanted to write stories before I could spell. So my mother recently found like all of these stories I've written just with notebook paper stapled together. And the very first story I wrote was about a little boy who had trouble making friends. So I almost feel like I started writing Macy Weaver at like six, because that plot to I Am Sam was eerily similar to Be Real Macy Weaver. So he wanted friends. He was going about making friends all of the wrong ways. And I'm like, have I had this idea in my head for like 30 odd years? But I kind of started as a little kid. My mom watched a lot of soap operas when I was a kid and they were always sort of in the background. And I tend to write with a good amount of drama sprinkled in there because I think I have a little background with The Young and the Restless. So it's kind of
when you've got a young adult novel coming out next year, right? Last Chance Dance.
Yes, I just found out that it's coming out in February, the month of love, and it's a little rom-com. So
are we going to see some of that soap opera drama unfold within Last Chance Dance?
It's so much drama. It is treachery and betrayal and enemies and heartbreak. It's a lot going on in there, but at the core of that story is finding what's in your heart, finding the right people that should be in your life, and learning to let go and start anew. So there's a lot of fun moments in there, but I think it's also a lot of empowerment for anyone who, you know, feels like I've been in this pattern for so long and this is where I should be. I think it encourages people to know that starting new isn't always, it's a little scary, but it's not, it's definitely possible.
There's some drama, of course, in Be Real Mason Weaver as well, but nobody gets slapped with a big emotional moment.
Editor made me take out the slaps because
Will there be slaps in Last Chance Dance, or is that a spoiler?
Are there any slaps? There are some, you know what? It's some like chair scooting, you know, like someone goes into someone's purse when, you know, you're supposed to ask first. And, you know, there's a little classroom tit for tat in there. So it'd be a little something.
So how does the Keita Wilson go from writing, I am Sam? Sam is not Sam, no friends for Sam. What
was the I am Sam. I just like kept the title simple.
So I am Sam. How do you go from there to getting serious? When does that start to look like when you think, oh, you know what? I could actually be an author.
You know what? Like I did not think that writing was like a real career that like I could do, even though I almost feel like teachers were always planting that seed from day one. In my school system, like Prince George's County Public Schools, we had a lot of writing programs. So we had like the program was embedded into our program. And we would take like a couple of hours a day and we would like work on stories. And then we would actually produce the book. Like we would actually bind it, display it, have others read it. And so like I had those moments. I know in like the sixth grade, we had writing workshop where we would spend 45 minutes writing pieces and then the class would like critique it. So I don't know why I still didn't think that like being an author was a real career, but it seemed so far removed. Like, you know, like where I'm from or just, you know, within my own family, it was, you know, you get a sensible job so that you can make money and provide for your family. And so like, while my mom was always like, oh, you have like a flair for the dramatics, like you should get into acting. Like that was like some hobby stuff. Like she wasn't saying like, make that a career. She was just saying, oh, you should dabble in acting, but get a real job. So I did not think that, that it was possible. Like I even worked in an independent bookstore, like in high school. And I saw authors come in and out of there all the time, like Caribou Books in Maryland. And I still didn't think it was possible. So time sort of went by. I got a sensible job. I became a teacher. Then I became a college professor. And then one day, I wanted one of my friends that I thought, because she had taken a couple of writing classes, I was like, oh, like, let's write something together because you're the expert. And so I like tried to get her to write with me and she was taking too long. So like, I was like, all right, well, I'll just start it off. And so I was like, all right, I'm like writing a couple paragraphs and like, you know, it was, so I got like a page done and then another page and I'm like, hey, like, are we gonna like, you know, get this done together? And then she, you know, she had a lot going on and she just couldn't do it. But, you know, I got to like the middle of it and I was like, oh, I'm writing a story. And so, I tried to put it together. It wasn't very good. I tried to query it. I had interest, but I didn't like, my craft wasn't where it should have been. And so I went back to school, got an MFA, and got really serious about how can I insert myself into publishing and be someone that could be like on an editor's radar. So that's what I did.
I'm always curious about that moment because there's nothing like that first book. I have never written a book in my own mind as good as my very first one because I was convinced it was perfect until other people told me it wasn't.
Yeah.
Was that your experience, or when did you realize that, oh, look at me, I can absolutely do this, but I need to improve?
I have a very weird backdoor way that thing has happened for me. Somehow, you know, I was writing that story, and in the back of my mind, I was like, well, if I ever finish this story, I need to have an audience. I need to have people that will buy the book. So I need to have like a group of people that will be excited about the book coming out. And so way before I should have been thinking about it, I started an Instagram page. I got really into Bookstagram, and I got a pretty good following going for a while. And I kept saying like, oh, there's this book that's coming out. And at the same time, I was like displaying like diverse books and I was doing all these different things. And I would just, you know, I would say, hey, this book. Then I had some artwork commissioned for the book. I was just like spending money that should not have been spent. So like, that's a, you know, writers don't commission artwork before you even finish. Don't commission artwork at all. Just write the story. But I did that. And when I put it online, an editor from HarperCollins was like, oh, those are really nice drawings. Like, what's, she emailed me. And I definitely thought it was a scam because why would, you know, an editor from New York email me? So I like looked at the name on the email. And I looked it up and it was a real editor. And so I emailed her back and I was like, yeah, I do have this middle grade. It was about something entirely different. And she was like, well, just send it to me. And when I sent it, it was not ready. And she was super nice about it. Like, she was like, okay, well, you know, and so that didn't work out. But someone else told me, she was like, why are you giving a manuscript to an editor? You need to have an agent. You don't just, you know, you don't just go about this alone. You need representation to make sure that if they, you know, are interested in acquiring your story, that, you know, your contract is right and all these, you need an advocate. So she put me in contact with an agent. And that agent gave it to me straight. She was like, this is not ready. You might need a developmental, you know, a developmental editor. She was like, but this is not the time. You need to go and like withdraw that manuscript from that editor and work on this some more. And so I did. And I continued to work on it. I entered the story into a contest. It was with SCBWI. And I did that on a whim because I think at that time I wasn't really getting any hits from other agents because I think some months had passed. I like worked on it, submitted it to that original agent. She said like, no, I'm just going to pass. I remember all the agents were like, no, 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 no. I was all sad about it. And then I think I want to say like that next February, it was like a cold day in February. I was like, no one likes me or my book. Lynn Oliver called from SCBWI and was like, oh, hi, Lakita. Like you know, you won this contest. And I'm like, no, are you sure? I literally said to her, are you sure? Because I had gotten rejected. I was like, and then I'm all like, but no agents like me. And she's like, oh, you know, agents are subjective, blah, blah, blah. She's like, but you won this contest. Like, you know, she's like, take the winnings. So all of that happened. I was still trying to query. I was going to school. And so in a perfect storm sort of way, I got my craft together. I wrote more stories. And finally, an agent was like, okay, I'm willing to take the story on. She did not take on that original story though. The one that I won the contest, the middle grade story that I won the contest with, like that one is still sitting collecting dust in a in my desk somewhere. Like that never went anywhere. But I took all of that experience one day in the middle of my MFA program, I was like, I'm going to just start a brand new story. And that ended up being Be Real Macy Weaver. So.
Gotcha. And that was the 2017 Emerging Voices Award that you won. Is that right?
Yeah, I won that for a story about a little girl who didn't have, there weren't enough diverse books in the classroom, which was like sort of going along with that Bookstagram page that I had. And a lot of agents liked the idea because, you know, it was so much conversation around that at that time that they were all like, yeah, we want it. And then as soon as they would get it in their inbox, they were like, I don't know. Let's just put that, like, you need to go back to school or something, like, you know, go ahead and work on that a little more. So maybe one day I'll be able to like pick it back up and do something with it. But sometimes, like, if you have spent years and years and years on this, like, one manuscript, and you have ripped it apart and put it back together so many times that it looks like Frankenstein. Honestly, like, I believe that the best thing to do is to release and let it go and start on something new. Because I realized when I started on a new novel, all of the things that I had learned, like, in my MFA program and by revising and through like agent feedback, I was able to use those new skills on that new novel, where it was really hard to apply those skills to that, you know, that novel that I had been working on for years, because I was too deep in it at that time, I think. So.
Well, unfortunately, and I think this is true of almost every writer, except maybe Stephanie Meyer, has got some shelf novels that are just, that's the thing you had to write to get where you were going to go. Yeah. But I do find that those can still be ransacked. There's ideas in there that were good ideas. I just didn't have the craft to pull them off. But I can still steal the initial spark and put that elsewhere. So I don't know if there's something like that that you can use for another book.
There are characters in that story that I could definitely cut out of that original story and probably put elsewhere, because I really like those characters. And who knows, like, you know, maybe one day I will be able to go back to it and, you know, revise it and really put it together the way it needs to. So I don't know. It's just like one of those things, this sitting in my shelf for now. So either I will scoop something out of there and use it with something new, or I will freshen it up and see if my agent wants to take a look at it. Maybe, like, I don't know, a couple of years from now.
What you should do is not edit it at all and send it to her and say, this is my new project. And then when she's like trying to figure out how to tell you it's not the project that she wants, you send her the actual new project, and it will look amazing by comparison.
I don't know. She might look at that and be like, all right. Like, because, you know, okay. So that project has been all over Root Literary at this point, because my agent wasn't even my, like, she was the assistant to the person who was querying. So who I was querying. Basically, when I won that contest, I want to say, it may have gotten on like Holly Root's radar. And so she had her assistant sort of reach out and be like, hey, you know, we heard you won this contest. Do you want to send us the manuscript? And I was all excited because I like Root. Like, they seemed like very female driven and modern. And like, I just like their approach to how they work with their clients. So I was super excited about it. I sent it to Holly. And I want to say it sat there for a while. I don't know if that manuscript was, I know that manuscript wasn't ready, but I actually sent Be Real Macy Weaver. I had written that. And I went back to Holly like some months later. I think they asked for it in like July, and I went back in October and was like, I'm just nudging about the first book. but if you don't like it, I have this second book. And they were like, okay, like, you know, just okay, give us that. And so I gave them the second book and I waited. And in that time period, Holly's assistant, Melanie, became an agent. And so some like a little while after that, she was like, I'm excited about, it wasn't called B-Roll Macy Weaver, it was called like something else. And she was like, I'm excited about this project. I want to work with you. Like, I'm not, you know, an assistant anymore. I've been training to be an agent. And so it was like two worlds collided. We became a perfect match. And here we are selling books.
Was the book by any chance called The Webs We Weave?
Yes. It was called The Webs We Weave for so long that like my friends are so ridiculous. Like they were like making up like show tunes to like, oh, The Webs We Weave. And I'm like, just, you know, nudging me about it all the time. And when that title got changed, they were like, all right, this isn't as child friendly. How about, and so like some ideas got kicked around and I was like, no, I don't want to get rid of The Webs We Weave. And then, and like looking back on it, I'm so glad we changed the title because I love B-Roll Macy Weaver. I do feel like there's like a certain catchiness that could catch a child's eye. So they were right. They are the, you know, they're the experts and they, you know, the publishing houses, they work on these things like every day. And so they knew. They knew what was best.
I should shamelessly plug for the audience that if they were to go back and check episode 18, they would hear the most wonderful interview with Holly Root. And they could also go back in the back catalog and check out my conversation with Molly O'Neill. So that's most of the Root literary team right there. And Melanie, if you're listening, and why wouldn't you? I've got your favorite client on. You should also come on the show. We'd all love to hear what you have to say and learn your perspective on why The Webs We Weave was not the most perfect title.
No, she's not the one. She's not the one who changed the title. My editor and, you know, that whole team at Penguin Random House, they were the ones that were like, all right, like, here's some options. How do you feel about it? And yeah, so. But do you know, like, this, not to like go back to the to Holly Root again, but I wanted to know more about the literary agency as a whole. And this is the podcast that I watched. It was so good and it was so long. I learned like so much history about the agency I was at, like just listening to her talk on here. So that's when I became a fan.
Oh, nice. Well, that's definitely standing.
Of the podcast.
So you mentioned, we kind of glossed over it, but I know esteemed audience had the same thought I did. How do you set up an Instagram so good that an editor randomly reaches out to you? Do you think it's just because you were covering books and maybe you might have covered one of the authors that they had some involvement with? Or
no, it was a lot of bizarre things that sort of like came together into the perfect storm. And this is how it happened. I had this Bookstagram page because I thought, oh, when I finish the story, I'm going to need this audience. And I was like, what do people want to see? Because they don't want to see me say like, one day I'm going to write a book and just like post that all day. I was like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to find all the book covers I can that have Black children on them so that it'll make parents and teachers and whomever, like, you know, when they want to know where are the, you know, the titles with Black characters, they'll be able to come to this page and they'll find them. And I'm gonna get all the up-to-date books. And so when I put that together and I just started like looking for all of the book covers with Black characters on them and books written by Black authors, people just started coming. And you know, it was in that really glorious time of Instagram where you could use hashtags and actually get followers, because it is not like that anymore. I don't know what happened, but you don't get followers as easily, like as organically, as 2017 was a really good year for growing your following. That was happening. So as I was posting all of these books and I started getting more followers, people in the publishing industry started following me, because then they wanted me to post their books. So then they started sending me books. So I had like editors and publicists and like all these people following me. So that was great. Then I commissioned the artwork. What I didn't know is I commissioned artwork from an illustrator who would go on like the very next year to become a New York Times bestselling illustrator. Like I waited, like I had to, she had a waiting list even before she became a New York Times bestselling illustrator. Her name is Katora Bobo, and she has illustrated picture books and YA, middle grade titles. Like she does a phenomenal job, but she hit the New York Times sellers list the next year. But the year prior, I had said to her like, hey, can you draw, you know, these three characters for me? And we like discussed what they would look like. And she created them for me. And I posted them. And because she's so talented, it caught the eye of the editor. That's what, and the editor was only on my page because they, you know, they wanted me to like post different books and things like that. Like not that particular editor, but just, you know, people from the publishing house in general.
Well, now earlier you said that you thought you had wasted money commissioning the picture, but now it sounds like maybe that wasn't such a bad business expense after all.
I mean, here's the thing. That editor actually saved me. Like, all right, by her saying, let me see the, you know, I would love to see the manuscript, it stopped me from self-publishing. If I had self-published that story, I never would have discovered how to work on getting my book published through like a publishing house, because I still at that time didn't know that was a possibility. When I was going to, you know, when I was going to write a book, I was just going to put it on Amazon because I just didn't see another path. No one had ever sat me down and said like, this is possible. Even though we had those writing workshops in school, even though we had write a book, all of these different things, I just didn't see it. I knew Judy Blume, you know, as a kid, but did I ever see Judy Blume? No, like we didn't see her. Like, you know, she didn't show up at my school. You know, E.B. White. I don't think he was still alive, you know, when we were reading Charlotte's Web. I didn't see authors. Like now authors are like coming into classrooms and they're visiting schools and they're showing children in real time that, you know, this is a career and it's possible for you because you can see me. But I didn't see authors at that time. So like, I don't know who I thought, you know, the authors were, but I just never thought it was a possibility.
And I know you have got a couple of different programs you offer, and you go and you do school visits now. So when you do those school visits, are you hoping to find those children who have no idea that authors are real people that they can meet, or?
Well, I actually don't do school visits yet. Like I actually have a little thing set up, you know, on my website that says like, these are the things that I will offer. But that's just me prepping because I know, like, you know, I have, you know, Macy Weaver coming out, and then I have some like nonfiction things. So yeah.
Well, plus teachers and librarians across this great nation are listening to this show as we're speaking, and they're thinking we need to get Lakita Wilson out here to the school. So. You're teaching and you move on to become a professor for early childhood development. At any point, is that in service of I want to write for children and this will help me along the way? Or is that just a happy coincidence that you happen to have that experience that dovetails nicely with what you're writing?
No, even though these two careers sort of complement each other pretty well, I didn't think about it. Like, you know, when I taught in the public school system, as I'm teaching at the college, it didn't really hit me that, oh, the next step could be this. It's just, I really love children. You know, like my mom used to always say, like, oh, you should act. But I always knew I wanted to be a teacher. Like, kids would like come up to me when I was like 7 and they would just like hold my hand. They're like, hi, you know? So like, it was a thing. I used to entrap my cousins, like in my room during summer break. And I was like, I'm the teacher and now you gotta learn. They're like, we just want to play outside, please. Like, we don't want to be here. And like, I would make them have school. Like, I always wanted to be a teacher. It was a passion of mine. I did it. I taught kindergarten. I taught third grade, fourth grade. And then I was teaching some courses at a community college, just on the side, and a position opened up and I was like, oh, okay. And I feel like for me, the only way that I could write full time is by having that job at the college, because like we don't work 5 days a week, you know, an 8-hour day. It's like, all right, like we have these classes that we teach, we can sort of stack our classes on different days. And what that does is it allows me to like write. Like if I teach on a Thursday and a Wednesday, then I can write Monday, Tuesday, Friday. And so it allows me to have the best of both worlds. And what I've realized is I teach my students a lot about, you know, child development and the way children learn, and, you know, the fact that when they are in the classroom, it's not just about teaching academics, but making sure that we are catering to the whole child and that, you know, their social emotional development is thriving. And then as I'm writing these stories, and especially like with Macy, I was like, oh, I have to put all of these skills to use. Like, all right, Macy is having an issue here in like the social emotional development category. Like, what is she feeling and where should she be? Like, I pulled from like from some of the knowledge that I know and like some of the things that I teach in the classroom. And since I've been writing and since I graduated from that MFA program, I've taken books and I've actually had my students at the college like read a middle grade and really look for areas of development, like in which ways, you know, is this main character struggling with their cognitive development or social, you know, social development, emotional, you know, and as their educator, you know, how would you work with them? So I've been able to sort of merge the two in this really interesting way.
I mean, theoretically, if you wanted to, you could be developing your characters with the help of students and others.
Students, I have an extra credit project for you.
Help me write a novel, secure bonus points for your grade. Everybody wins. And so you get the MFA. When in there do you start working with learner books on the My Cool Jewelry and My Awesome Hair and Nails and et cetera?
Oh my gosh. I am the most impatient person on the face of the planet. And when no agent would take me on, I was like, you know what? I'm going to write anyway. So, you know, so I would just like, I would answer all calls. Like Twitter was really good for me, like with finding work. And so like Capstone would put out these all calls and Learner. And I would put my little work sample together and I would give it to them. And eventually they would answer back. And I remember one day, sort of close to the time where I hadn't won that award yet, but every agent was like rejecting me. Someone from Capstone called and they were like, do you want to write this book about, which one did they say first? I think they were saying like do you want to write this book about Rosa Parks and this book about Thurgood Marshall? And I was like, yes. And then they called back like a day later and they were like, all right, what about this book about Michelle Obama? And I was like, yes, yes, yes. So I had so much fun. Like I got to write about historical figures, and then I got to write about a figure who was making history right now. And so I think there was a lot of handholding there, because again, I was still building my skills as a writer, but with those experiences taught me, because they're so fast paced, they don't give you like a year to write your novel or write your, you know, whatever project it is. They're like, can you turn this around in 60 days? And, you know, yeah, okay. And so you just do it. They taught me how to, you know, look in the margins for their notes and how to revise appropriately and how to follow direction and pay attention to word count and be very concise with what I'm trying to say. Because I know, like, for that Rosa Parks book specifically, and I'm just throwing a number out because I can't remember the word count, but they may have said like it has to be 1200 words. And I'm like slicing and slicing and slicing. And I get down to, well, I have to talk about her on the bus. Like, you know, I only have 1200 words. I'm like, I can't, I have all of this stuff that I have, you know, researched about her. You guys are making me slice it. But I learned how to keep what was necessary and toss out the extra from those experiences. And from that, I think that's the only way I could have transitioned over to what is Black Lives Matter, who is Colin Kaepernick, because that was very similar to those capstone and learner experiences, where it's a faster pace. But I think with those two subjects in particular, the Black Lives Matter movement, Colin Kaepernick, who still has, you know, so many people just villainizing them. I was able to stay in my word count and also add on, how do I write this story in a very truthful manner for young children, knowing that there's going to be so many opposers of like what I'm writing. I don't know if I could have done that without the Rosa Parks experience and the conversations that I had with my editors then about what children should be reading and what they're ready for, because those were definitely conversations that we had when I was writing those books for Capstone, especially the Thurgood Marshall story, because there's an instance, and I remember having this like back and forth email with my editor then, because there was a moment where Thurgood Marshall was basically hunted down by the police. Like, he was riding along and then they were trying to get him and take him into the woods. And like, it was, you know, they were gonna do something not so great to, you know, Thurgood Marshall. And I was finding a way to write it in an age-appropriate way. But I think the editor at the time didn't want me to say that the police had done, like, you know, the police had followed Thurgood Marshall, because she didn't feel like children were ready to hear that the police didn't like Thurgood. You know, like, the police, I wasn't writing about the police in a flattering manner, because, you know, they were following Thurgood Marshall.
They weren't acting in a flattering manner. So
I mean, that's all I'm saying. I'm like, you know, I feel like, you know, like, I feel like there's a lot of fear around like what we tell children. But I also feel like there's children that live in neighborhoods specifically, like, I mean, I know mine for sure, like where I grew up, where I live now. where it's not just children reading about Thurgood Marshall and what has happened to him with the police, but it's children that are walking outside of their homes and they're racially profiled at 6 and 7 years old. So if they are in danger of experiencing these moments, of experiencing racial profiling, then they're ready to read about it. And I mean, maybe not even them, but you know, like maybe their family member or someone close to them, or it's just happening around their neighborhood, you know. That's sort of why I felt strongly about that moment. And I have to go back and look. I don't even know if that is still in the final copy of the book, but I do remember having that conversation.
And it's an unfortunate reality that those two topics, Black Lives Matter and Colin Kaepernick, would be controversial or police behavior at a time when we all know the country was openly racist. I don't think that stopped, by the way. I think that continues on, but certainly we can look back at Thurgood Marshall's time and say clearly, obviously, that shouldn't be controversial that say, hey, in this world where racism was openly happening, some people were acting in a manner that was racist and they happened to be in a position of authority. I know yeah. It's controversial. When writers who are listening to us or watching us are wanting to tackle issues like this, what kind of blowback do you get for presenting this for children, and how do you deal with the blowback that comes your way, or did any?
I think I thought that the pushback was going to be stronger just because, you know, if I get on Twitter today, I can find someone speaking out against, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement. I could see people, you know, just like attacking Colin Kaepernick. So, you know, I felt like writing these stories, they're not stories, like writing these nonfiction projects would bring that negativity or that sort of attack to me, but it really hasn't happened. It did happen like once where someone walked into the library and saw the book and they took a picture and they were like, this is lies. This is all lies. And like, you know, she's like all over, you know, Twitter saying like, it was just really, you know, I was really wrong for like spreading lies. And it's just interesting to me because I have been through the process. Like anyone who has been through the nonfiction writing process with a publishing house knows about the fact checkers and the, you know, all the people who are making you prove each and everything. When I wrote the you know, who is Colin Kaepernick, we had like a back and forth several times over Colin Kaepernick's height in high school. Was he 6'4"? Was he 6'5"? Like, you know, it's like, we're trying to figure out which one it was. And if the fact checkers and the editors and everyone else cares enough about that tiny fact, then I don't think that they're going to just let me slide with saying like, because they were really upset that I had said, I was talking about the, you know, hands up, don't shoot moment. And so I'm like, I pull from my sources, the fact checkers, you know, they double check and triple check. And before it goes out, you know, we have enough references to back up whatever we say. But I mean, I didn't respond to the person, but in my mind, I was like, okay.
Well, unfortunately, and not to make too broad a generalization here, but it's my experience, the sort of person that would take the side that all lives matter, or blue lives matter, are not moved by facts. They're reading news sources yeah. that do not, they deal with alternative facts. There is no concrete information. There are no points we could agree with. And so some of those folks, I know I personally had to excuse myself from conversation, like, okay, one of us is talking about real things that actually happened and one of us is talking nonsense and I have things to do. Have a nice day.
Yeah, honestly, because I mean, when I know that there's going to be no progress in a situation, I'm not like, I won't engage in that because it's just, and then I'll be all upset And I have things, you know, like I have things to do. I want to write like the next project. So yeah.
You mentioned that you only had the 12,000 words for the Rosa Parks story. And obviously, most of us know what we know about Rosa Parks, if we know nothing else, is what happened on the bus. So I'd almost love to see a story where it was like, I don't know, Rosa Parks begins, or Rosa Parks : origins. And it just ends with her getting on the bus and you tell us everything that happened.
Let me tell you, Rosa Parks on that bus is like the tip of the iceberg. Like that... Oh my gosh, like she comes from this family of activists. Like it is deeply rooted in her. And she was standing up for herself. She was standing up for her brother. She worked with, she had done so much work for the civil rights movement with like voting rights and getting people to the polls, doing some activism work with like transportation. That wasn't bus related, but like with the trains, it was so many things that I learned about her. And one of the things that I do like to do when I have children's projects is read like the adult books, because you know it's like so much information in those, of course, like a 400 page memoir or nonfiction project on the person that I get to know more about them and then sort of pick the highlights from there and put it into, a children's project. But yeah, that could definitely happen. But I think someone already did like a picture book on Rosa Parks where it wasn't about the bus. It was like about... I have to think about it, but someone actually did that. But there's still so much information about her that it definitely could be more projects on Rosa Parks. Yeah.
One more question I want to talk a little bit about diverse books, and then I want to dig into to Be Real Macy Weaver. But sure. Since you ran the Instagram specifically around reading diverse books, and I ask every publishing professional who comes on the show what they're doing, what their agency is doing to increase diversity in publishing, why not talk to an author, Instagrammer, who's been watching the market as well? How do you feel publishing is doing about increasing diversity? Where are we at? How much further do we have to go? Or is the road ever onward?
I think looking at the numbers, looking at the facts is the best avenue to take. I mean, people can tell you anything, right? Like right after, right after George Floyd was murdered in 2020, and there was this big movement in publishing about, we're going to do all of these things to open up doors for Black writers. There were a lot of people saying it. And they were, opening up their DMs, and I was one of those people that I was like, okay, if you're opening up the DMs, I'm going to get in there and, see what's going on. And there were so many people where like you would get in their inbox and just, they were like, okay, I let you in, but I'm going to be super general and then goodbye, so you sort of felt like whatever they were saying on their main was a little like performative. But I will say, that's how I began my relationship with my main editor, like the person, Kelsey Murphy, who has most of my, who purchased or acquired, most of my projects, like my fiction and nonfiction projects. She opened her DMs. I sent her the longest paragraph in the world. It's like super embarrassing, but I was just like, hi, blah, blah, blah. Like I just gave her all this information, too much information. And she was actually nice about it. She was like, okay, and she was like, okay, this seems lovely, blah, blah, blah. And like, we talked about all these different things. And then she was like, yes, like have your agent, like reach out to me. And so that began the conversation with us. And she actually backed up what she said. She was like, this, it's my mission to do better. And she, you know, she's super open to like a lot of different things that I want to work on. But the numbers are not reflecting equality in publishing, you know, like I feel like, I guess, you know, there's an article that just came out, right? Where like James Patterson is saying like, oh my gosh, like the white man is not getting published. It's a travesty. And you know, it's all this is going on. And I'm like, no, you're still very much in the majority. And so I think until we see the needle move a little more, I'll like really believe that the doors are opening. Because I mean, the door is cracked. Sure. Like the door is cracked. I slipped into that crack, but I want to see the doors open. And because really, like if you walk into a bookstore now and you look on the shelves, there's still sections for the African American interest books. You know what I mean? And so like the whole store, it's full of white authors and, you know, books featuring white characters. But I want to get to a day where I walk into the store and it's like, I mean, you're really seeing a mix. Like we don't even need, there's too many books for it to be a special interest bookshelf. So, yeah.
You're here. You know, I have disliked James Patterson since I read Cat and Mouse because I felt like he cheated the mystery on that one. I was, this shames me to say it, but I liked the Alex Cross stories for a time. But that book, Cat and Mouse, where he did two first-person perspectives, there were detectives. Alex Cross gets injured at some point, and so he's out. And so we have the first-person narrative from a detective who turns out, spoiler, to be the killer. It's a first-person narrative. And I threw the book, and I was like, you knew the whole time it's a first-person perspective. You can't do that, James Patterson. I'm done with you. And after his recent comments, I'm done with him forever.
I have never...
too strongly, almost hatred for James Patterson.
You know, I was neutral before, because like, I have never read a James Patterson book. So I was neutral before, but now I'm just like... Now you're giving me a reason to do it. Like now you're giving me a reason to frown at you. Cause that was just, it was so unnecessary to say, like, I don't know. But
I do wonder about him. And of course the other obvious example is J.K. Rowling. I wonder when these authors, they get so big that nobody can tell them no anymore. And their whole thing is you want to hear my perspective. You want to hear my point of view. So I must be right. I can't figure out, like J.K. Rowling in particular, it bothers me because she's had enough people push back against her now that you think it would just occur to her that, hey, maybe I don't have to say everything I think all the time. And we could just go back to making that Harry Potter money.
But I don't think it affects her pockets. I don't think it affects her pockets. I don't think it affects her day-to-day life. I don't think it affects the big or small picture for her. And so she feels like I can say whatever I want. I mean... I think when you get on those levels and you're making so much money, like you're a machine. And so I think they're just able to get away with it. I mean, if someone said, all right, if you say this, you like there's things I want to say at my job, like my actual day job, but I would not like to lose my job. So there's certain things that you don't do or say at work. And I mean, not even like a bad thing. Like I would like to wear pajamas to work. It would be comfortable. I, you know, would probably be frowned at and it would be like, yeah, like don't come back to the classroom in pajamas again. I'm not gonna, you know, I'm gonna dress up for work because I want to keep my job. You know, it's gonna affect my money. I think when you get on her level, it just, she's still gonna be in her castle. So she doesn't care.
Hey, quick life hack. My wife has discovered if you buy a nap dress, is it a nice dress? Is it a nightgown? It's a little column A, a little column B. It's
put a little belt around it.
Nope, that makes sense that that these people become an industry into it and of themselves. But at the same time, it bothers me with J.K. Rowling in particular, because she touched my soul. She touched a lot of people's souls. We all love Harry Potter. You know you did, esteemed audience. You're listening to a book about middle grade, or a podcast about middle grade fiction. Probably there's a decent chance you liked at least one of those Potters. And I know that I feel like we're all Luke Skywalker and she's Darth Vader now. Like, we can sense the good in you. There was something there. What happened?
I think I would like to be successful at this writing thing. I want to touch the hearts of readers, but I never want to get to a point, or anyone that I know, or anyone that I don't know, I don't want to ever get to a point where I'm so out of touch with reality that I can shut my phone off so that I don't see the tweets or the, you know, any of that, and no one around me tell me that I'm wrong. Like, when you don't have that, you get really loose-lipped with what you say. Like, I don't know. I think you always need people around you to sort of check you. Like, hey, that's really ridiculous. Like, let me tell you why. Let me try to help you out and steer you in the right direction. And does she have that? Like, I don't know. I don't know. Because no one wants to be kicked out of the inner circle now, because, you know, it's J.K. Rowling. So I think she has a lot of yes men and women around her. And that's it.
Well, may that never happen to either of us, but may we get that readership, because there is a way to get that readership, but without the without the downside.
Exactly.
Well, that, of course, brings us to Be Real Macy Weaver, because the readership is coming when they read this thing. True to my word, I will not make you sit through me summarizing your book. What does esteemed audience need to know about Be Real Macy Weaver that they can be pre-ordering as they're listening to us, or depending on when they're listening to us, you just go out and buy it?
Macy Weaver is a girl who wants a best friend so badly that she will do anything to get it. And I mean anything, including sabotage. She means well, but she's also a little desperate. And, you know, she goes a little far with it. But then, you know, I don't want to give away the ending, but she doesn't have a bunch of yes men around her, thank goodness, because she gets checked a bit, and she gets it right. But it's just a girl who wants what we all want. She wants love and support, companionship. She wants a sense of belonging. And so I took a universal theme, because I feel like, you know, that's part of human nature to want to belong to something or some community. And I dug into my own little childhood a little bit, and I created a story that I think middle grade readers will be able to relate to. And even, I mean, older people, because, you know, we have our friends as kids, and then, you know, we become adults and we get on that first job and we're like, oh, okay, I need to find my community here. And so it could be a little tricky. So look for everyone.
Oh, here's an impossible question to answer, because I know the answer is everybody, but do you have an ideal reader in mind for this story?
I want children who are you know, that 8 to 12 age group, but who are coming into themselves. So, and I guess this could apply to so many different age groups, but I really want to reach kids who are trying to figure it out, like who they are, or they're in their, you know, just being at school or being in their neighborhood, and they're realizing that they're a little different. It's a little harder for them to sort of like conform with, you know, what they see everyone else doing. I want them to know that it can be super cool to be different and to bring your own like unique qualities to the table and just sort of like stand in your own space and just, you know, be like, this is who I am. And I want the, you know, I don't want to go to people and sort of like conform to them. I want, you know, people to notice me as my authentic self and embrace me. So it's just mostly for kids in that late elementary, early middle school, who are trying to find their way.
And we talked a little bit about I Am Sam, which is about a boy who needs to find friends. And now we've got Macy Weaver, who's also desperate for friends.
Yeah.
Were you good at making friends as a child or not so much?
No. Oh my God. No. Terrible. So let me tell you, I either didn't do enough or I did way too much. And I usually did way too much. I'm sort of still like this. Either like don't want to be bothered at all, or I have way too much energy and I want to be in the mix. And people didn't know what to do with that type of personality because I was a lot. Like, I was a lot. And I marched to the beat of my own drum a little bit. And people were like, what are you doing? Like, that's not the cool thing to do. Or, you know, you need to act like this. You need to dress like this. You need to do this. And I tried, like, fit in like so badly, but Lakita popped out, you know, like, I would be like, let's do, you know, whatever. And the things that I thought were fun or what I thought was funny or just, I don't know, I did a lot. I had a lot of energy. And it was very like, you know, in my day, a million years ago, like, you know, kids were all about conformity. I think in this generation, kids are being really brave and embracing their, you know, unique qualities. But like back then it was like, look, everyone wear a pair of Nikes. you know, like I remember being on the bus in like the third grade and I had this like colorful backpack on and this girl like bullying me because I didn't have like a designer leather book bag. And I'm like, I'm in the third grade. Like, you're supposed to have a cartoon book bag. What is the problem? But like, there was this big, you know, there was a big push for everybody has to fall in line with what is cool. And if you weren't falling in line with that, then it was time to, you know, put the spotlight on you for like, oh, she's not good enough or whatever. So no, I definitely struggled. I think it was like my senior year of high school, like Macy and Pax in the story, it's me and my best friend. Like, we were outsiders completely. I found him. I saw him before 12th grade, but we really got close 12th grade. And like, I was like, oh, it's another person like me. Okay. Like, you know, so, and we've been like inseparable ever since. So you just have to find your people.
But now that you've fallen in with the Society of Children's Book Writers, you're surrounded by your colleagues who are also professors at the college. Do you feel like you've found your tribe?
There were similarities. Like when I went to school for the MFA program, I was like, oh, these behaviors, like, okay, like I probably would have been friends with you guys in elementary school because that was one of the few places that I can be like, I could be completely myself. And they were like, yay, Lakita. But like, you know, I couldn't just go into my office and like be super silly and also like share my feelings. Like, I don't know. I just felt very authentically myself in school where I didn't really, you know, feel that any other place than like with my friends. So yeah, like, I don't know. I think the book community has the right amount of nerdiness that I always needed, because yeah, I've found some people that I really gel with.
Yeah, it's one nice thing I love about chatting with authors, either through this podcast or in real life. So I love authors in general, but yeah. It makes me feel like, oh, I'm not crazy. We all are. Oh, that's nice.
We were all spread out all over the country. We were just away from each other, and somehow we're like moving closer to each other through the book world. But yeah.
Well, I don't think we're going to get into spoilery territory, but this one reason why I don't summarize other people's books is I've blown the ending before, and I'm not going to do that, but I do want to talk a little bit about Maisie's relationship with her mom, because her mom is not particularly redeemable, at least early in the story. I'm looking at this as, you know, a grown man who's in a marriage, and I'm thinking, oh, if I'm married to this woman, this is going to be a problem. This is not going to be okay.
Her mother is kind of a mess. And can I just tell you that I saw a review for Maisie Weaver recently, and someone said, this is the it made me laugh so hard. She said, this is the worst mother in middle grade history. And I was like, whoa, she didn't even spank anyone. Like, but in a very, like, the thing is, I wanted her to present like she was this, oh, I'm so sweet. Like, you know, I'm talking to you in a sweet voice. But you're full of it. You're just full of it. Because like when we think about abuse or neglect or like any of those bad qualities, right? With being a mom, we always, you know, well, I don't know. I always think about, you know, like someone with a switch in their hand, you know, they're about to spank someone or slap someone or something, right? But there's so many moms or dads or whomever, right, who they're not going to do that, but they're still not going to be a very good parent either. And they're not really willing to accept the fact that they're not doing the best job. And they might think that just being like, oh, sweetie, giving you a couple of sweeties and a couple of like kisses on the cheek will leave an impression that they have been a good parent. But they haven't, because like she would just be like, oh, amazing, you know, and like do all of that, but she wasn't there. Like, I don't know if that's spoilery, but you know, like it was like just sort of painting over a pile of garbage. I don't want to say painting over a pile of garbage, but like she was just like, I don't know. She really wanted to believe she was a good parent, probably to ease her own guilt, which was another part of her selfishness, but she just wasn't. And I wanted to show that because kids are living with parents or not living with parents who do that every day. So while that, you know, that reviewer in particular was like, oh my God, this is the worst mom. I think the mom, you know, I think there should have been some closure or something. I sort of feel like, no, like let her be exactly who she is, because we don't always get the perfect mom or the perfect dad or whomever. And so let it be what it is. And I'm sure that there will be some kid out there who will relate to that.
As I read, I both disliked her and was excited for you, because I'm like, oh, you nailed it. I've met this person in real life. These types of parents are out there.
And I've met those people too. Outright
villains, but they're not villainous.
Yeah, because I remember saying about a particular person one day, like, they don't seem like they would do that. They're so sweet. Like, they, you know, and, you know, like whenever we... not whenever, but like sometimes we hear about someone doing something heinous, and then it's like always somebody in the background going like, but no, they were at the bake sale, like volunteering, or they were like doing this or that. And no, they would never do that. It's like, no, you can present very well and still not be a good person. So, yeah.
Well, in all fairness, I wouldn't, and this is my reading of it, but I wouldn't go so far as to call her a true villain so much as just a deeply flawed human.
Well, that too, because I think even like Maisie realized, like, the mom was looking for something too, I think. So it was like, and oh my God, I just realized it just now. She wasn't a part of the original people, like trying to find themselves, but I realized like, that's what the mom was doing the whole book too. Like she was trying to find herself. Like Maisie, that's her theme. Maisie has to discover who she is in order to find her community. And I purposely like threaded some of that into like Pax and Bren and Grace. I did it on purpose, but I didn't do it on purpose with the mom. But I'm realizing like she was trying to find herself too.
What? That's just coming to you right now as we're talking.
Yeah. Okay.
That was really striking. I give all kinds of credit for, wow, yeah. Thematic unity. You nailed it. But now I know you must have been subconsciously. That's incredible. I think on some level you had to know that's what you were doing, because it's very apparent in the novel. But I love the idea that maybe it's just coming to you tonight.
I honestly I wrote her to be one of the reasons why Maisie was so needy, because she's so needy because, like, you know, her mom is just off doing other things. But what in the world? Okay, breakthrough tonight in the middle of the podcast. You are being credited with major breakthrough. Well, now I have to go back and ask.
Next novel, we'll talk it through. We'll see if we can figure something else out.
I need to ask my editor if we ever talked about that, because I'm like, I don't remember that. But yeah.
I remain convinced that even if you weren't consciously aware, you were definitely subconsciously aware. It's too well done to not be. In fact, we can burn this podcast. No one ever has to know, and we'll just say it was always the plan.
Right.
Try to think what else I can ask you without spoiling, because I did want to talk a little bit about what Maisie does when she's weaving those webs. Is it spoilery to say that Maisie says some things that are not true in her attempt to impress friends?
Oh, she's been lying since day one. So that is not a spoiler. That's just what it is. Yeah, Maisie has a more than small issue with lying, and she's not doing it to be malicious, but she has to get it together because it just completely spiraled out of control. But yeah, that was a day one thing, definitely.
That's I think that's, you would know better than me, given what you teach, but I think that's pretty common among children. I know I had a phase where I was born to tell lies and prove fiction. I just didn't have a book to write yet. So I told lies directly to the people around me for a time when I was, you know, first, second grade.
I was a habitual liar. I mean, it was so bad. They were so intricate. And like now I realize it was just like the storyteller trying to, like, you know, escape. But I just couldn't help myself. I mean, I guess now that I'm writing, I have less reason. Like, I don't have to lie. I can just, like, you know, write a story. But like, I remember keeping a lie going for like months. Like, I told my cousin that this group, like Crisscross, was like performing concerts in the woods behind my house. And I'm like, she's like, oh my God, can we go right now? And I'm like, look, they are really busy celebrities. We don't want to bother them. But like, I had her staring out the window. Like, it was just a whole thing. And I was really believable too. So I'm glad that I found another outlet so that I have broken that bad habit. But I definitely Definitely. I did it for fun, and I did it out of insecurity, you know, like, you know, when you are like, let's say like a true story, like, you know, you're a kid and everyone's like, those aren't the right sneakers. Those aren't the right sneakers. I don't know, you know, you might go, well, that's because I don't mess up my, you know, I don't wear my good sneakers to school. You know, I just, you know, that's for after school with my other cool friends, you know, like you just make something up so that you're just not on the outside. Like it hurts to be on the outside when you're a kid, because you don't, like when you're a kid, everything is the biggest deal. Like this is your world and you don't see beyond that. You don't see that in like 5-10 years, it's all going to get better. You're just like, this is terrible. They're all coming after me. So, you know.
Yeah, no, there is no 5-10 years. It's all right now, maybe a month from now at the furthest.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in all fairness, in some cases, it doesn't get better. Oh, well, that's... Oh,
gosh. Don't tell the kids that.
This has been Inspiring Thoughts with Rob.
Don't tell them it gets worse. No.
Some of you are right.
But you know, like, I feel like when you're a kid, you're thrown into this situation where, like, they're like, all right, here's a group of people, figure it out. You're going to have to be friends with someone. And like, there's nowhere to go. You don't have a car, you know, like you can't barely cross the street. So that's, you know, that's the only reason why I feel like, you know, at least when you're an adult, you can be like, oh, this scene is not my scene. I'm going somewhere else where like, I will find some people that are cool, like that, you know, mesh well with me. But ugh, as a kid, it's like
the broadest possible group, right? Because it's based on the age range of people in your area. So like you're going to meet people that will go on to become adults you would not associate with if you met them as an adult later on. But you're forced to spend time with just by age and then, you know, the lottery of birth.
Yeah.
Makita Wilson, have you ever seen a flying saucer and or a ghost?
I have been ready for this question since, yeah, okay. No, I have not seen a flying saucer. However, my best friend and I have spent lots of time on YouTube, like looking at like those alien videos and just like imagining, like we're like, we know that there's something else out there, but we just kind of feel like it's something that we can't conceptualize, like we don't have the ability to put together in our own minds. It's like something that like we never thought of. So like those alien videos on YouTube with like, you know, whatever they found in what was it called? Not Dangerville. What is it? Roswell?
Oh, Roswell. Although Dangerville is a better title or a better name.
Sorry, idea. But those, the way that they are shaped, we don't think that they're shaped that way. We think it's just something like we can't even wrap our heads around right now. And then, no, I haven't seen ghosts, but I do have a funny little something about ghosts. I have an extreme phobia of ghosts. Like it's really bad, but it's also really ridiculous. And it started with the National Enquirer and Lucille Ball. One day I was a kid, I was in the grocery store. I passed the National Enquirer and it's like a picture of Lucille Ball on the cover. And they're like, this child has seen the ghost of Lucille Ball. She came to visit them. And I was so afraid. I slept outside my parents' door for weeks. And I was like, I'm not going into my bedroom because Lucille Ball will be like peeking in the window. And that started a lifelong, my friends do not take me seriously anymore. That started I have a lifelong fear of celebrity ghosts. And it makes no sense whatsoever that I believe that when a celebrity dies, that they're coming to, like, I won't walk past my, like, I don't want to get out of bed to go to the bathroom. Like, who just died? Well, I know my biggest one is Michael Jackson. Like, I was done. Like, I don't even want to look out the window right now. Like, I don't like the thought, like, no one can send me a meme of Michael Jackson, like, nothing. I'm really afraid. The aunt from Moesha, like, it's just like all these like random people that do not want to come and visit me. They don't know me. Like, so I don't know why in the middle of the night I can't sleep, because I'm like, oh no, Tupac died and he could be just like blowing past my window right now. It's not logical at all.
But it's like you could have the most amazing concert going with all the ghosts.
Michael Jackson, Tupac, and like Kurt Cobain are just standing out in the front of my window. Like, I don't, why? Of all the people on earth, why would they come and visit me? And I can say this to you, but I guarantee if I'm left alone, none of this makes sense. I'm just afraid. And it's lifelong thing. Lifelong. It's terrible.
You're going to be in bed tonight and you're going to hear some taps against the window, and then you're going to look over and you're going to hear, Lakita, are you okay? Are you okay, Lakita?
And I will scream. Oh my gosh. Like, and there's so, I mean, it has been, it has been such a running joke that they're just like, really? I mean, like, they're like, hey, I saw this really, like, someone dressed up as Michael Jackson and did this like thing, but I know like you're afraid of Michael Jackson's ghost, so is it okay to send it to you? Like, they're asking permission to like send me things. I'm like, I really need to get it together, because that's just not an okay phobia, and I understand this, but it is there.
In all fairness, Mrs. Kent will leave the room if the video for Thriller is on, because of the moment at the end when his eyes turn, and it's a childhood scare. It's deep trauma from way back when, and she's not here for it.
If we had cable as a kid, I wouldn't have made it past that moment. I was super duper old when I saw that video. I was like late teens when that's sad. That's super sad. Like, because that's a part of my culture, but I did not see that Thriller video for a long time. And when I did, I was like, yeah, that's pretty scary. I don't like that big boom at the end with him turning around. None of that. Yeah. Terrifying. Yeah,
but as a teen, it's a catchy song. Fair enough. And some nice.
Oh, I loved the child. Song.
Oh, no.
Evidently, like, I was like in my crib, like singing Beat It all the time, like nonstop. So I like the music, but don't show me the ghost at all. Yeah, felt good to get that confession out there.
Lakita, you want to be starting something? Fair enough. Well, so this has been an absolute privilege and a pleasure. I've so enjoyed talking with you. I'm gonna stop now before I make the whole thing Michael Jackson jokes until the end of the video. We gotta walk away while it's still fun. My last question for you tonight, but I know you've got books. You're booked up through 2024, not with just with Last Chance Dance that's coming, but some other projects we can't talk about yet. Is that right?
Yeah.
You're gonna be around. Come back and we'll do this again sometime.
I would love to.
For tonight, my last question is always some variation of, if you could go back toward the start of your career, middle of your career, wherever would have made a difference, and give yourself some advice that would have made easier your path and might make easier the paths of anyone who's watching or listening to us now, what would you go back and tell yourself?
I think I would tell people, and this is like really hard to tell someone, you know, who's like still in the trenches, but I would encourage writers not to worry. Like, you know, I spent a lot of time worrying, like, you know, will an agent ever, you know, like my work or want to represent me? Will an editor ever want to acquire my work? Will a publishing house ever actually, you know, will I get through acquisitions. And now I'm literally, you know, like I have something about to publish, and now there's like a new worry. And it's like, oh, well, you know, will I get enough visibility, or will readers love my story? Will they even like my story? Like, there's so many things to worry about. And I think sometimes when we spend our time worrying, it sort of stops us from moving forward, and we get like stuck in that moment. And so so cliche to be like, oh, everything's gonna be okay, but I was rejected by, I mean, so many agents. Like, there's some agents that have rejected me like legit 4 or 5 times, and I just found unique ways to like come back. Like, well, I changed it a lot, so you want to take another peek, you know? And they're like, sure, but still rejection. So I feel like if I went through like over 100 agents that just, you know, did not want my work, if I you know, went through so many editors, like with my first project that went out on submission, where like everyone was like, no, just no. And that project hasn't even been announced yet, but you know, it took a while to sell it because everyone was like, this is going to cost the publishing house too much money. No, like, this is, I don't understand this. No, like, you know, just over and over. If I can go from all of those no's to, you know, an editor saying, yes, yeah, I want to buy this. And also I want to buy some more of your stuff. And here's some of my colleagues, and they want to buy some stuff. You know, like, if you can go from that to that, there's always hope. And so it's hard to tell someone, don't worry, but try not to worry and try to write widely, which is what my MFA program, Vermont College of Fine Arts, taught me. Learn how to write a picture book, middle grade, YA, write historical, write contemporary, coming of age. Learn how to move in those directions so that you'll always have something to sell, and then find out what works best for you. Because if picture books don't, if you write a picture book and you absolutely hate it doing it, then don't do it. You know, like, don't just stay over there. But you might find that, yeah, I like picture books, and I also like to dabble in YA, and you know, it makes you more versatile and more able to work in this industry.
Where can I'm so tempted to say, and then somebody says, the two of us need search no more. We've both found what we were looking for. It's me and Akita. Oh no, it's dead Michael Jackson again. Oh.
I have started something.
You have. I'm going to be thinking
of Michael Jackson memes for days.
Michael Jackson will say as a dead creepy ghost. That's going to be my, I'm probably going to write a whole novel about it now. And since you've
inspired you.
Captured my imagination. Where can esteemed audience find you online, follow you on social media and all that good stuff?
Just at Lakita Writes. Twitter, Instagram, I'm there. Yeah.
And as always, esteemed audience, for more information about me, and more importantly, for interviews with thousands of editors, literary agents, authors, all the world's best people, head to middlegradeninja.com. Keep an eye out for news about my new dead Michael Jackson novel coming soon. And God willing, I'm alive. I'll see you next week.